darting over the church spires of Brooklyn, heading home, expectant but unburdened. Free. Her incentives had finally changed. Part 3. Finding Leo. Chapter 36. This time, there was no tea or coffee or little butter cookies or imperious Francie, who, upon hearing that Leo had gone missing, sighed and said, "Oh, he'll get sick of roaming and wander back. He's a Long Islander at heart." As if she were talking about one of her border collies. This time, it was just the three Plums and George, who wasn't even sitting down. That's how eager he was for the meeting to be over. "Even if I knew something," George was saying, hurrying to add, "and I don't. I don't know anything. But even if I did, Leo is my client, and I probably couldn't tell you." "But you don't?" Melody said, surprising herself by hitting what sounded to her like the perfect caustic, disbelieving note. It was so perfect, she tried again. "You don't," she said, drawing out the syllables a bit too much this time. Still, not bad. "I don't. I swear to you, I don't. But again, Leo is my client." "We all understand attorney-client privilege, George," Jack said. "You don't have to keep saying it." "Well, then, respectfully, why are you here?" "We're here because your cousin, our brother, has essentially fallen off the face of the earth," B said. "He's vanished, and it's worrisome, to say the least. We want to try to figure out where he is and if he's okay. What if he needs help?" George pulled out a chair and sat. "Look," he said, "I don't think Leo needs help." "You do know where he is," Jack said. "I don't. I have my suspicions. I could make an educated guess, but I don't know anything for sure." "Then how do you know he doesn't need help?" Melody asked. George rubbed both sides of his face with his hands vigorously, inhaled deeply, and exhaled. "At one time, Leo had money that Victoria didn't know about. An account in Grand Cayman. To be clear, I don't know this as his attorney. He mentioned it years ago when he first opened it, and, you know, I thought it was not a bad idea, given how things started to go with Victoria, to keep some money separate."
"And you hid it during the divorce?" Jack said.
"I didn't hide anything. Leo filled out the asset sheets. I asked if they were truthful. He said yes. He didn't list an offshore account, and I didn't ask."
"How much money?" Jack said evenly.
"I don't know," George said.
"Enough to have paid all of us back?" Jack asked.
"At one time, I believe there was enough in there to have paid you all back. But now? Who knows? It's Leo. He could have spent that money a long time ago."
"Or he could have doubled it," Jack said. "He had enough money to take off. It had to be a decent amount."
Even though he'd told himself over and over that Leo had money hidden, he was stunned.
"I would agree with that assessment," George said. "But I'm guessing, just like you are."
"You were right," Melody said to Jack. "You were right all along."
"This is so messed up," Bea said.
The three Plums looked at one another, lost in their confusion, trying to process a betrayal much more significant than the one they'd been dealing with mere minutes earlier.
"I don't understand how this happened," Melody said.
"It's not hard," George said. "Anyone can open an account like that. It's perfectly legal."
"I'm not talking about banking,"
Melody snapped at George, who leaned back as if she'd slapped him. Melody's face fell. She started crying. Bea poured everyone water. For many agonizing minutes, the only sound in the room was Melody hiccuping and blowing her nose.
"I'm sorry," she finally said. "I'll be okay."
"Of course you will," George said, attempting to soothe.
"I mean, I'll be broke, and we're going to have to sell our house and tell the girls there is no college fund, and I guess we're genetically connected to a sociopath."
The tears started flowing again, and when she spoke, her voice was choked.
"But I'll be fine."
"If it makes you feel any better," Jack said.
We're probably losing our summer place.
It doesn't make me feel better, Melody said. Why would that make me feel better? I feel absolutely horrible for all of us.
Jack tried to console her. He wanted her to pull it together. He hated displays.
It's just an expression, Mel. I mean that I know how you feel. I do.
I'm worried this is my fault, Bea said. She told them all about her story, how it was based on the night of the accident and how she gave it to Leo to read, wanting his approval.
Maybe if I hadn't done that, if I'd just thrown it away.
Jack interrupted. Don't. This isn't anybody's fault. This is who Leo is. What he didn't say out loud was that he knew who Leo was because he was that person, too. He'd always seen too much of Leo in himself. Maybe not quite as bad as Leo. Leo Light, for once and for always. But close enough to know that if he had a big bank account somewhere and could get on a plane and disappear, he might do it, too. Leo has always been this person. Self-preservation at all costs.
What about Stephanie? Melody turned to George. She's pregnant.
Shit, George said, clearly surprised. Did he know?
I don't think so.
Shit. George sat and tapped his pen on a legal pad. It sounded like tiny bullets firing. We could hire a private detective. People do that. We could try to trace his steps and see if we can find him.
Then what? Melody said.
Nobody spoke. Let me make some calls, George said. One step at a time. Let's just see if we can track him down.
God, my eyes are going to be so swollen tomorrow, Melody said, pressing her lids with her fingertips. I feel nauseated.
Can we have a minute alone, George? Bea asked.
The three of us?
Absolutely. George stood, looking like a kid who'd just been let out of detention hours early. As much time as you want. Bea dunked her hand in the water pitcher and grabbed a fistful of ice, wrapped it in a cloth napkin, and handed the makeshift ice pack to Melody.
Here, for your face.
Thank you, Melody said, leaning back in her chair a little and pressing the ice to her eyes. She started humming. Jack rolled his eyes at Bea, who motioned for him to zip it.
Relax, Melody said, sensing Jack's disapproval through shut eyes. This is psalm time.
I didn't say a word, Jack said.
You didn't need to.
Psalm time? Jack said. I approve.
Hooray, Melody said.
They sat listening to Melody hum for a minute or two, something from West Side Story. Sondheim didn't actually compose that show, Jack said. He wrote the lyrics.
Jack?
Bea cut him off.
Not now.
She stood and smoothed her skirt, cleared her throat. Listen, I have an idea, a proposal. I don't need my share of the nest. I'm okay right now. I'm not going to lose my apartment. I don't have kids with immediate financial needs. Leo has obviously forfeited his claim. So if you two split what's there, the $200,000, that should help, right?
No, Melody said, removing the soggy napkin from her eyes. Her mascara was smeared, her nostrils red. I'm not taking your money. That's not fair.
But I want you to, Bea said. We can call it a loan if that makes you feel better. A no-interest, no-deadline loan. I know it's not enough for either of you to completely resolve the loss, but it's something.
Are you sure? Melody said,
quickly calculating that Bea was giving them one entire year of tuition, more if it wasn't a private school, which increasingly did not seem to be in the cards.
You don't want to take some more time and think about it?
I've thought about it a lot in the last week. I don't need more time.
Because if you're sure, Melody said, yes, it would help.
I'm sure, Bea said, visibly pleased.
Jack?
Yes, Jack said. I consider it a loan, but yes. The extra money wasn't enough to completely extricate him from his mess, but it might, just might, be enough to buy time for the house or maybe to get Walker to start taking his phone calls again. It won't be quick, but I'll pay you back. Okay, Bee said, sitting back down, pleased.
Good. Good, this is progress.
And if George can find Leo, I'll go and talk to him.
He won't find him, Jack said. And even if he does, nothing will change.
I can try, Bee said. I can try to change things.
Melody blew her nose, rooted through her purse for more tissues. She had the hiccups.
When did Leo start hating us? She said.
Nobody responded.
How was it so easy for him to leave?
She wasn't crying anymore. She was spent.
Was it really just about money? Was it about us?
People leave, Jack said. Life gets hard and people bail.
Bee and Melody exchanged a worried look. Jack didn't look good, and he wouldn't talk about Walker or the fight at the birthday dinner. He'd fiddled incessantly with his wedding ring since they sat down.
Besides, he said, a little brighter now, arms spread wide, what could possibly be wrong with any of us?
Bee grinned, Melody too. Jack laughed a little. And as they sat, trying to muster the momentum to make their way out of the office, they all thought about that day at the Oyster Bar, seeing Leo's agreeability then for what it really was. Jack wondered how he, of all of them, the one the least susceptible to Leo, could not have been more suspicious about how disarming and humble Leo had been. Bee remembered how it had seemed that Leo was maybe, kind of, taking responsibility and evincing a desire to make good. How he'd leaned forward and put his palms on the table and looked each of them in the eye, sincerely, affectionately, and told them he was going to find a way to pay them back, he just needed time. She remembered how he'd asked them to trust him, and how she believed, too. Because Leo had lowered his head, and when he looked back up at them, damn if his eyes weren't the tiniest bit damp. Damn if he didn't seduce them all into giving him the slack he probably imagined he'd have to work much harder to obtain. How grateful he must have been in that moment, Melody thought, to discover how little they were asking from him. To realize how eager they were to believe him.
Chapter 37. Exactly 10 days after the birthday dinner, Walker moved to a new place. He would have left the next morning, but it took him that long to find a short-term rental that wasn't too far from his office. Until the minute Walker wordlessly lugged 2 boxes and 3 suitcases loaded with clothes into a taxi, both he and Jack thought he was bluffing. The story about the statue had unraveled with stunning celerity the night of the dinner party. After Stephanie's unfortunately timed announcement about Leo's disappearance, Walker had pulled Jack into the kitchen. "If Leo hasn't been around for weeks, how have you been meeting with Leo?" Jack equivocated, but that only made Walker assume he was covering up an indiscretion, an affair. Jack had no choice but to explain, and as he watched the color drain from Walker's face, he almost wished he'd made up some kind of flirtation to confess instead. Walker had slowly removed his apron and folded it into a neat square. "What you are doing is not only against the law, it's completely unethical," Walker said, practically spitting out every syllable.
"I know how it sounds," Jack said.
"Don't," Walker said. "Please, please do not try to justify what you're doing right now."
"But if you could see this guy," Jack said, "you might understand. He's a complete wreck about having that thing in his house. He needs to get rid of it. I'm doing him a favor."
"Do you even hear yourself?
Walker, he lost his wife when the towers fell."
"What does that even mean?" Walker was shouting now. "I'm sorry about his wife, but how on earth does that justify what you're doing? Aiding and abetting a black market art sale."
Walker was pacing now, and he stopped and slammed his fist on the counter. Jack was scared. This was worse than he expected.
"When the towers fell? Jesus Christ, what else, Jack, what else? If you don't help the terrorists win, these colors don't run, never forget. Am I ignoring any other pat jingoistic sentiments that you've previously reviled but might now summon to defend your abhorrent greed?"
It's not greed.
It's what?
The last thing Jack wanted to do at that moment was confess the home equity scheme. But he didn't see how he couldn't. If he waited, it would just be worse. "There's something else," he said. Walker listened to Jack without saying a word. When Jack was finished, Walker walked to their bedroom and closed the door behind him. All their communication since then had been through terse emails. Jack learned from Arthur that Walker had put the summer property on the market. He sent Walker a series of imploring emails, begging to talk, however briefly. They all disappeared into the great abyss of Walker's fury and silence. Walker had surprised himself. It wasn't like he didn't know Jack. He did. He knew exactly what Jack was and was not capable of. It wasn't as if Jack hadn't done dumb things over the years and tried to hide them. God, where to begin with the dumb shit Jack had done over the years? Always failing, always. He was terrible about covering his tracks. Walker realized that he'd tacitly agreed to subsidize Jack's failing efforts years ago. He pretended optimism every time Jack had a new trick up his sleeve, quietly paying off lines of credit that never materialized into revenue because that was what you did when you loved someone, when you were building a life together. Your strengths compensated for their weaknesses. You became the grounding leverage to their impulses, ego to their id. You accommodated. And if Walker got impatient, if he sometimes wished things were a little more balanced, he would just imagine his life without Jack and recalibrate, because he couldn't imagine life without Jack. But something inside him had snapped the night of Melody's birthday. He was genuinely horrified when the story came pouring out of Jack about the illegal sale of the Rodin. It was illegal. Whatever stupid things Jack had done over the years, breaking the law was a first, he assumed, he hoped. If he'd gone ahead with the ridiculous scheme and gotten caught, Walker couldn't even bear to imagine what they'd be facing, and not just personally. For him, the repercussions would be professional. It was beyond imagining. As he'd stood in their kitchen that night, watching Jack try to explain himself and toggle between evasive and indignant, Walker's years of resigned tolerance evaporated. In the coming weeks, he would spend a lot of time trying to unpack that moment, not understanding himself how years of commitment and love and tolerance could just vanish. But they did. As he stood and watched Jack, he realized that for more than 20 years he had parented his partner. And on the heels of that debilitating thought, a brief flash of insight that leveled him. The reason they'd never had a child, something Walker had dearly wanted but had never been able to persuade Jack to want, was because Jack was the child. And Walker had let him be the child, enabled him. His husband was his 44-year-old petulant, needy, responsibility-avoiding son. And now it was too late for other children. And with that realization, Walker was undone. He thought he'd come to peace with the child decision years ago. It didn't bother him that much anymore, just the occasional twinge. But seeing Melody's daughters, so lovely, so sweet, had set something off, and then when Stephanie said she was pregnant, he was overwhelmed by such a sudden and unexpected melancholy that he had to leave the room to breathe. Then the confessions, forcing Walker to stop ignoring Jack's careless, greedy heart. It was as if on the night of Melody's birthday, a yawning crevasse had opened beneath him and he couldn't clamber up the side to safety. Every day, all day, he felt a kind of vertigo, as if there were nothing holding him up, just a dangerous looming beneath, a valley of regret and waste. The night before he moved out, he panicked. What if he was ascribing grief from his own decisions to Jack's behavior? What if he was being unfair? What if he owed both of them another chance? He walked into the apartment after work, if not entirely willing to reconsider a separation, at least willing to have a conversation. Jack was in the bedroom with the door partially closed, talking on the phone. He was arguing with someone. He was insisting he could find another buyer, encouraging the person on the other end to reconsider. He hadn't, as he'd emailed Walker repeatedly, called off the sale of the statue. He was still trying to make it happen. That was that. Walker would take whatever proceeds he could get from the house on Long Island and buy his own place. He'd help negotiate Jack's line of credit. He supposed they'd have to get divorced, but he was in no hurry to start legal proceedings. He'd probably end up paying for all of that, too. Chapter 38. The night of her non-birthday dinner, when she'd found Nora and Louisa in Jack's bedroom and asked them what was wrong and why Louisa was crying, the night she wouldn't let up until Nora finally blurted that they'd seen Leo in the park in a compromising position, and then they both, in an effort, Melody now realized, to deflect from what would come out days later, the missing SAT classes, Simone, pointed to the wedding photo of Jack and Walker, Melody still believed the evening could be salvaged. Absurdly, she continued to believe it the whole time Jack and Bea were interrogating Nora and Louisa about the day they'd seen Leo in the park, and she'd even held out hope while Stephanie was disgorging the contents of her stomach in the corner of the living room, and then the news of Leo's disappearance. It wasn't until Jack and Walker started fighting in the kitchen, hushed voices quickly giving way to shouting, that Melody finally realized dinner was never going to be eaten, the cake never cut, the pretty limoncello never poured. She drained her champagne glass, removed her dressy sandals because her feet were killing her, and wondered if it would be rude to sneak into the kitchen and grab the remaining champagne from the ice bucket.
"Come on, birthday girl," Walt had said to Melody. "Put on your coat and let's get pizza."
In the following weeks, Melody stewed and nursed her disappointment like it was a tiny ember that couldn't die because she was carrying fire for the whole tribe. Then the phone rang one Saturday, the SAT place asking if she was willing to fill out an online survey explaining why Nora and Louisa had dropped the program. Had there been a problem with the tutor? Because they'd received other complaints. It was Walt who finally stepped in and calmed everyone down. It was Walt who negotiated a refund for the tutoring. It was Walt who Nora found in his office one late night when she went to apologize for lying about the SAT classes and admitted, eyes apprehensive, smile blinding, that she liked a girl. It was Walt who Louisa and Nora approached together to tell him they didn't care about the college list, they wanted to look at the state schools.
"I'll take a year off," Louisa told him. "I would love to take art classes and live here with you guys."
"I can take a year off, too," Nora said. "We can work and save money."
It was Walt who treated each of them with equanimity and grace and pure, unadulterated love, who enveloped them with his comforting arms and said about everything, "Please, stop worrying. This is not your problem. We love you so much. Everything will be fine." It was Walt, finally, who put the house back on the market and found them a clean and spacious short-term rental. It was Walt who became the general. The day they accepted an offer on the house, he hustled everyone out for Chinese food.
"To celebrate," Melody said bitterly.
"No," Walt said. "To eat." Sitting in a roomy corner booth, Melody was trying to be calm, civil. She was on her second beer, and the alcohol was going to her head. The food arrived, and it looked wrong. All wrong. The relentless, glistening brown of the platter of chicken and cashews offended her. The pink-tinged pork, why was it fluorescent pink? Scattered in the greasy fried rice nauseated her. The steamed dumplings that looked like wrinkled, water-soaked fingers made her want to scream. Walt's idle chatter about their new bedrooms and shorter commute infuriated her. He didn't seem to realize that the apartment being closer to the school was not something to brag about.
"Aren't you hungry?" Walt asked, pointing to an untouched egg roll on her plate.
She looked down at the egg roll. It looked fine, plump and crispy. She remembered how much she'd loved egg rolls as a little girl,
until the night she'd grabbed one and dunked it in the neon orange duck sauce and took an enormous bite, and just as she started to chew, Leo had leaned over and said, "Do you know what they put in those to make them so good? Dead dog." It took years for her to believe that he'd been kidding and try an egg roll again. Leo always ruined everything.
"I'm not hungry," Melody said, pushing her plate away. "You can have this."
"Do you want to order something else?"
"Is something wrong?" Walt asked.
"Is something wrong?" Melody said. She was holding a fortune cookie in her fist and gripped it so hard it shattered and pieces flew across the table.
"Yes. Something's wrong. A million things are wrong. In case you haven't noticed, Walter, our entire world has recently turned to shit."
Something hard flashed across his face. An almost subliminal message like the words you were supposed to see spelled out in the ice cubes of liquor ads. Something that in this case might say, "You've gone too far."
"Excuse us," Walt said to Nora and Louisa.
Melody sat and watched Walt stand. "Can I speak with you, please?" he said. Melody looked at Nora and Louisa sitting wide-eyed. And finally, Walt took Melody by her upper arm and half-guided, half-pulled her to the back of the restaurant, near the restrooms.
"Enough," Walt said. "What are you doing? Why are you manhandling me?"
"I'm tired of you insisting on being miserable. Nothing here is going to shit, to use your charming phrase, including our children, who might take your outlook a tiny bit personally. Enough. Get back to the table and apologize to Nora and be the person you've always been for them."
"I wasn't talking about Nora," Melody said.
Walt walked away in disgust. She was stunned. He'd never spoken to her in that tone or touched her in any way that wasn't purely affectionate. She stepped into the restroom to compose herself. How dare he? She hadn't been talking about Nora.
Okay, maybe she had been talking about Nora. A little. God forgive her.
She bent over and washed her face and looked at herself in the mirror. She looked horrible because she was horrible. How had she been so wrong about everything and everyone? Not realizing Nora was gay and not knowing how to talk to her about it and, by extension, about anything. Not noticing the girl's deception. Not understanding Leo was a liar and a thief. Not being the type of mother who would sacrifice a house for her daughter's college tuition. Not willingly, anyway. Not lovingly. She didn't know who she was anymore. She didn't know how to be the person she'd always been. Besides, that person had been a bit of a chump, hadn't she? She walked back to the table, where everyone was silently chewing, watching her approach with, she ruefully noted, dread. She sat and picked up her egg roll. She tried to say, "I'm sorry," but she couldn't speak. She took a bite and thought, "Dead dog," and spit out the food in her napkin. Without a word, she grabbed her purse and went and sat alone in the car. Through the large restaurant window, she could see Walt and Nora and Louisa. They were eating, but not talking. All of them silently passing platters and chewing while looking down at their plates. She tried to imagine she'd gone somewhere, just disappeared without a trace, and this was their life now. A husband without a wife. Daughters without a mother. The tableau was so unbalanced and incomplete and sad. Walt said something and the girls shook their heads. They each took a little more food from the big platter in the center. They kept looking over at the other side of the room, away from the window, all of them. She wondered if someone they knew was sitting over there, or if they needed the waitress for drink refills or takeout cartons. The staff at this place had a habit of disappearing when you needed something. Nora probably wanted more fortune cookies. Walt leaned across the table and took one hand of each daughter. He said something to them. She squinted and leaned forward as if she might be able to read his lips. She wondered what he was saying. The girls were looking at him and nodding. Then smiling. Then they all turned and looked across the room again, and she realized what they were doing. They were looking toward the door. They were looking for her.
Chapter 39. It was a Tuesday, which meant Jack opened the shop a little early after having been closed on Sundays and Mondays. Tuesdays were the days that most of the decorators made their rounds because the stores weren't full of weekend amateurs or tourists, but the morning had been slow. So what else was new? Jack was sitting at a small desk in the back of the shop. He'd been making a few calls, writing emails. The front door opened and a little bell rang announcing someone's arrival. Jack stood and couldn't quite make out the person in the door. The sun was shining through the transom and hitting him square in the eyes. Jack? Yes? He squinted and moved out of the light and let his eyes adjust. Melody?
Hi, she said a little meekly. I brought you some lunch.
So let me get this straight, Jack said. You've brought me these delightful sandwiches and cookies and even an overpriced bottle of sparkling water because you want my advice on having a lesbian daughter? Melody sighed and picked some kind of dark, wilted lettuce off her sandwich. Why was it so hard to find just a plain turkey sandwich?
What is this stuff? She said, sniffing it. Arugula. Ugh. Whatever happened to good old iceberg lettuce?
She put the sandwich down and looked at Jack.
I don't want advice exactly. I don't know what I want, to be honest. I guess I'm a little scared.
Of having a gay child?
No. Of being a crappy parent.
Because she's a lesbian?
I'm not trying to be an asshole, Jack. I've never cared that you were gay. You know that. None of us did. You were the one who didn't invite anyone to your wedding. Which is a shame, because we all would have liked being there. It might have been nice for your nieces, too, to see their two gay uncles marry.
Well, now they have a front seat for the groundbreaking divorce. Melody put her sandwich down.
Seriously?
I'm afraid so.
But why? There's no chance of putting things back together? What happened?
I did a very dumb thing. Can we talk about something else?
Sure.
They were sitting at the counter at the front of the shop, next to the jewelry display.
This is nice, Melody said, picking up a red leather box with a vintage watch inside.
Yes, it is nice. It's the watch I gave Walker as a wedding gift.
He gave it back?
Actually, he sold it back to the person I bought it from who alerted me, and I reacquired it.
I'm sorry. That sounds upsetting.
It was, very. Especially since he sold the watch to buy combs for my long hair, and without knowing what he had done, I sold my hair to buy a leather case for this watch. Melody smiled at him and put the watch back on the counter.
We're selling our house.
She pinched the bridge of her nose between her thumb and forefinger. She really didn't want to cry again in front of Jack. Our house is on the market, too.
They say it's picking up, the market, Melody said, mouthing Walt's words.
Fuck the market, Jack said.
Yeah.
They both sat chewing their turkey sandwiches for a few minutes, avoiding looking at each other. Then Melody said,
Remember those friends you had in high school?
God, is this going to be a lunch of examination and remembrances? Because I'm not in the mood.
No, I have a point.
Which friends?
All those boys.
Again, I'll need you to be more specific.
All those boys that summer, the ones from the pool club, remember? You'd bring them home and hang out in back under the trees.
Jack's eyes lit up. He did remember. The summer before he left for college, he'd brazenly brought home a series of beautiful boys from the family beach club, all of whom worked at the restaurant, clearing tables and refilling water glasses. The coveted waitstaff jobs in the dining room were doled out to the collegiate sons and daughters of the membership, who pocketed the tip money they didn't really need to fuel their alcohol or drug habits, or both. Even then, Melody knew there was something different about how Jack and his friends would pull their chaise longues to the far end of the yard and slather each other's backs with Hawaiian Tropic, misting themselves occasionally with her mother's little plant atomizer,
the pretty brass one meant for the African violets on the sill of the summer porch. Melody would try to find an excuse to wander over whenever she could, offering glasses of lemonade or fudgicles from the freezer. The boys would stop laughing and talking as she made her way across the lawn, squinting to see what she had in her hands.
"Want one?" she'd ask.
She always brought an extra for herself, hoping to be invited to join them. But Jack always grabbed whatever she had and shooed her away.
"I remember very well," Jack said to Melody, "the good old days under the pine trees, when life was so much simpler and merry and gay."
"They were gay, right?"
"Not all of them, some of them. Enough."
"Why didn't they like me?"
"What?"
"They never liked me, those gay boys."
Melody was trying to keep her voice light, casual.
"I was always trying to hang around, and you all were always trying to get me to go away."
"You were a little girl."
"So? I brought you guys stuff. I brought you drinks and ice cream, and all I wanted was to maybe play cards or listen to you talk or anything. But you and your friends never liked me. So I was wondering why, if it was something specific."
Jack sat back and crossed his arms, grinning at Melody like she was telling a particularly excellent joke. He started to laugh, but her expression became so raw, so Melody walking wounded, that he stopped.
"Mel," he said, putting a hand over hers, "they didn't hate you. You were adorable, stumbling over the grass in your saggy two-piece bathing suit, carrying a pitcher of warm lemonade or melting popsicles that tasted like freezer burn. You were adorable."
Melody stared down at her half-eaten sandwich. She couldn't look at Jack. She was mortified now that she'd brought the whole thing up, and mortified to hear his take on her pilgrimages across the grass, and particularly mortified that hearing him say, "You were adorable," made her so happy. He continued, and his voice lost its usual sardonic edge. "Whatever happened under the pines, it wasn't about you or liking you or not liking you. That's just crazy. I was 17. I didn't want to have you around because I had a 24-hour erection. I didn't want my little sister there."
"Gross."
"Exactly. Think of it as a different form of brotherly love. Is that what you've been obsessing about because of Nora? Whether you have some kind of built-in gay repellent?"
"No, I'm just thinking. I want to do the right thing. I want to understand and be supportive. But I'm scared. I don't know what she needs anymore, how she feels."
"Yes, you do."
"I don't, Jack. I don't. I never wanted a girl."
"You do know," he insisted. He stood and gathered the garbage from lunch and shoved it into an empty grocery bag. "You wish she weren't gay," he said calmly.
"Yes, I'm sorry. I'm not saying that to be hurtful. I don't want her life to be any harder than life already is. I don't know how to smooth the way for this, make it easier. I don't know what to say or what to think or how to behave, and I don't know who to talk to. Except you."
Jack was staring out the window of the shop, tapping his fingers impatiently against a display case. "Walker wanted children," he finally said.
"Really?"
"I was nervous about the whole thing. You know me. He wanted to adopt, and all I could think about was how do we know what we're getting? It seems like such a crapshoot. How does the kid know? Nobody signs up for two gay fathers. It seemed like such an easy thing to fuck up. Walker would always say I was overthinking. He would always say, 'There's a reason they call it giving custody. Parents are temporary custodians, keeping watch and offering love and trying to leave the child better than they found him. Do no harm.' That's what Walker would say anyway. I don't know if it helps."
"It helps a little," she said.
"Just another example of my selfishness, according to Walker, as he walked out the door."
"Not wanting to adopt?"
"Yes."
Melody thought for a minute. Why was it so easy to wound the people you loved the most? She pointed to an Art Deco bar cart a few feet away with crystal bottles filled with a dark liquid. Is that real alcohol? She said.
It most certainly is, Jack said. Are you suggesting a drink? Because if you are, you are my favorite person in New York right now.
Yes, she said.
Jack filled half their plastic cups with scotch, and they sat and sipped in a companionable silence for a few minutes.
I don't think you were being selfish, Melody said.
About adopting?
Yes, she said. I think you were being thoughtful and cautious and honestly airing your concerns. Having kids isn't easy.
I know.
Don't get me wrong. It's great, and I think you and Walker would have been great parents. If you both wanted it. But it's not for everyone.
She finished her scotch and poured a little more. She was building some alcohol-fueled momentum. Do no harm, she laughed. It sounds so, so easy. But do you know what else is easy? Doing harm. Accidentally doing harm is distressingly easy.
I don't think you were being selfish. I think you were being realistic.
Jack watched Melody, amused. He wasn't surprised she was a cheap date in the booze department, but what she said also resonated with him and made him feel better. Tell that to Walker, Jack said, joking.
I'll tell him, Melody straightened. Where is he? He thinks being a parent is so easy, such a cakewalk. Get him on the phone. I'll tell Mr. Attorney just how easy it is. Where is he?
I don't know. Let's see. Jack took out his phone, and she was abashed to see him open the Stalkerville app, the one she'd talked him into using. Let's take a peek, he said, waiting for it to load. Here we go. He's at work, and look. He pressed the call button on his phone and held it up for Melody to see as the screen said Walker, and the phone rang and rang. He banged the phone onto the counter. Melody picked it up. What are you doing? Jack said.
I'm deleting this. If you want to tell Walker something, you should go find him. This thing?
She raised the phone and shook it a little.
It's not telling you what you need to know. It's one tiny part of the story. It's bullshit.
She typed in a few commands, and the app was gone. Jack was looking past her lowered head and out the window, watching the pedestrians walking down the street on a heart-wrenchingly perfect spring day. He'd never felt so alone in his entire life. Handing him back his phone, Melody realized that Jack's scattered, slightly unfocused gaze, his too long hair, and his wrinkled shirt, it all added up to heartbreak. He wasn't mad or blithe. He was empty. Mel, he finally said, Nora just needs to know you love her as much and exactly as you did before. She needs to know she's not alone.
I know, Melody said.
She sat with Jack for a while, wishing she could erase the look on his face, a world of comeuppance and regret. Chapter 40. It was the day before Mother's Day, and Stephanie was still wearing her down vest. May in New York City was fickle. On Friday, she hadn't needed any kind of overcoat. But Saturday dawned cloudy and cold, more autumnal than spring-like. Still, there were bunches of pink and purple and blue sweet peas at the farmer's market, and she splurged and bought 4 bouquets for herself. She'd scatter them around the house, and their heady scent would permeate every room. Vinny and Matilda were coming over to her house for lunch. The day when she'd answered Leo's phone, she quickly ended the call with Matilda, saying Leo was out. She didn't forget about the call, or the poor girl who'd been in the car with Leo, but there was so much else for her to contend with. Weeks later, she'd called back, out of duty more than anything else. Stephanie knew she wasn't responsible for Leo's mess, but as Matilda nervously and somewhat disjointedly explained why she was calling, Stephanie realized she might be able to help. One of her favorite clients, Olivia Russell,
was a hugely successful journalist who had written extensively about artificial limbs, especially the challenges facing Gulf War veterans. Olivia had lost a leg herself when she was young. She knew everyone and how to work every program and now ran a nonprofit that helped amputees navigate the expensive and complicated world of artificial limbs. Stephanie offered to broker an introduction. Matilda asked if she could bring her friend Vinny. So they were all coming for lunch, Vinny, Matilda, and Olivia, who'd already agreed to help Matilda as a favor to Stephanie. Then Stephanie's job would be done.
Happy Mother's Day,
the farmer who took her money said. She assumed he was a farmer anyway. He was scruffy and already sun-weathered. His fingers were thick and blunt and dirt-stained, and he was wearing a bright blue baseball cap that said Shepherd Farms Organic in orange script on the front. It took Stephanie a minute to realize he was addressing her.
Oh, thanks, she said.
With her height, she was carrying the pregnancy well, but at 6 months her bulge was prominent, unmistakable.
You have other kids at home?
Nope, first and last, she said, employing the emotionally neutered tone that she'd learned usually shut down baby conversation, shifting her bags of spring potatoes and asparagus and strawberries into the crook of one elbow so she could carry the vibrant flowers in one hand, like a spring bride.
Yeah, that's what they all say, the farmer said, grinning. Then the kid starts walking and talking. Soon he won't sit in your lap anymore. And before you know it,
he gestured toward her middle.
You're cooking number two.
Hmm, she said noncommittally, holding a palm out for her change. She'd listened to her pregnant friends complain for years about the invasiveness a protruding belly engendered. How even in New York, where you could stand inches away from someone's face on the subway, secure in the tacit but universal agreement that nobody, sane, would engage with you, ever, all bets were off when you were pregnant.
Boy or girl, first one? When are you due?
Stephanie always heard when are you due as what do you do? Always. So she had been prepared for the annoying questions. But the thing she found most infuriating was how everyone needed to talk not only about the baby she was gestating, but also about her unplanned, unwanted future children. It was so odd. As if only wanting one child was already undercutting the motherhood that hadn't even officially begun. As if these strangers had something at stake in the process. As if having one baby alone was some kind of half-hearted gesture, a part-time commitment.
Oh, they're just jealous.
Pilar, mother of one astonishingly charming and erudite 9-year-old son, told her. They want to make sure you're going to be knocked back on your ass as soon as you're sleeping all night. Misery loves company, my friend.
So, do you know what it is? The farmer said, counting out her ones.
It's a girl.
Got your name?
Yes, she said, smiling thinly.
But that's my secret.
She'd learned to keep her counsel on baby names the hard way. When she started mentioning names she was considering, before the obvious one occurred to her, everyone had an opinion based on logic so subjective and personal that it was utterly bizarre.
My first wife was named Hannah, and she was a cold bitch.
My daughter has 4 Charlottes in her class.
Natasha is kind of Cold War, no?
It also seemed to Stephanie that, like so much else surrounding parenting, naming had become a competitive sport. Some dude in her childbirth class couldn't stop talking about his Lotus spreadsheet for baby names. We have 3 priorities, he explained to a bored Stephanie and a bemused childbirth instructor. She'd seen it all. The name needs to be unique, needs to reflect the ethnic background of both my wife and me, a little bit Brit, a little bit Jew, and, he paused for effect, it needs to be mellifluous, pleasing to the ear.
I know what mellifluous means, Stephanie said.
Sophia is the type of name we're going for, his wife added in her clipped BBC accent, but it's much too popular these days.
It's popular because it's pretty, Stephanie said. A classic old-fashioned name.
Too popular, I'm afraid, and the classic tips to trendy. the wife said, putting a sympathetic palm on Stephanie's arm, who she clearly thought was hapless and uninformed. In addition to the top three priorities, the husband continued, we have subset qualifications. He ticked off the items on his fingers. What happens when you Google the name? How many syllables? Is it easy to understand over the phone? Is it easy to type on a keyboard? The last one was too much. Stephanie burst out laughing. The couple hadn't really spoken with her again. Good luck, the farmer said, waving his hand as she walked away. This'll be the only quiet Mother's Day you have for a long time. You let your husband pamper you. This was another thing that surprised Stephanie, although she supposed it shouldn't. How everyone assumed, because she was pregnant, that she was also married. She lived in New York City, for Pete's sake. Not just New York, Brooklyn. She wasn't the first 40-something woman to have a baby alone. But even if she was having the baby with someone, who said she was married? Who said her someone wasn't another woman? She wasn't only offended by the near unanimous conventionality of everyone's automatic assumptions. She was unsettled because she knew her daughter would eventually face the same kind of cavalier reasoning about a father who, well, who knew what the story with her father was, what it might be when the baby was old enough to ask. Stephanie redistributed the shopping bag so her shoulders and arms were evenly weighted and started to walk home. It was downhill from the park to her house, thank goodness. Her legs felt strong, but her center of gravity was shifting, and her back hurt if she walked too far while carrying packages. She should get one of those shopping carts on wheels, but she'd be pushing a stroller soon enough. Stephanie was still annoyed about the farmer's husband comment. There wasn't much about having a baby alone that stymied her except what to tell people about Leo, whether to tell them about Leo. Her closest friends and co-workers knew the story, sort of. They all knew about Leo and their past, how he had briefly resurfaced and that she'd been surprised but happy to find herself pregnant, and now he was no longer in the picture. It was harder with the casual acquaintance or the out-and-out bold and nosy stranger. Many people were stopped with a curt, "I'm a single mom," but many weren't. She was going to have to come up with something specific enough to shut everyone up, but not intriguing enough to encourage questions. She also hated the looks of pity and concern that accompanied her deliberately upbeat clarification that she was having the baby alone. Pity was such an absurd sentiment to be on the receiving end of because all she felt was lucky. Lucky to be having a baby, lucky to be forming slow but encouraging bonds with Leo's siblings and their families, which she was doing specifically for her daughter so that she would have a sense of her extended family. Stephanie was the only child of a widowed mother who had died years ago. She'd loved her childhood and her doting, accessible, smart, and funny mom. The only regret she had about not having a baby sooner was that her mother was gone, and her mother would have been an amazing grandmother. But Stephanie had been lonely sometimes as a girl, too, so she hoped the Plums would embrace her and Leo's baby, and so far, they were. If Stephanie was perfectly honest with herself, she knew that the particular family configuration hers was about to take was her preferred configuration, because it was what she knew. If she was being scrupulously honest, one of the reasons she'd never had a kid was because having a father in the picture was something she didn't know what to do with. It wasn't really something she'd missed. Her mother and her cousins and summers in Vermont with her beloved uncle satisfied her craving for family. In the middle of the night, in the dark, where nobody could see the satisfied smile on her face, her hand on her rising belly, she recognized that although this baby hadn't been premeditated, it hadn't, Leo had shown up at her door, the night of the snowstorm she didn't insist on a condom. Something she had, quite literally, never done before. Not during the most inebriated hookup. Not during the most spontaneous erotic moment. She hadn't planned the pregnancy, hadn't, but she hadn't prevented it. And if she was being brutally honest, deep in the night in the privacy of her room, hand on her belly gently rising and falling with the undulating motion of her rolling, kicking, hiccuping baby, listening to the quiet of her creaky house under the duvet arranged exactly as she liked. She could admit the truth about the night of the snowstorm, that she'd let a tiny aperture of possibility open to something that was of Leo, but wasn't Leo, and that she liked it that way.
"You're more like a guy than a girl," Will Peck had said to her once when they were together, and she suggested he might want to sleep at his place a little more often. He didn't appreciate her love of solitude. She supposed that was true, in a way. Although she didn't buy the stereotype of women being the needy ones, it seemed wrong. Sure, there were women hell-bent on getting married, but men were just as bad, once they decided they were ready to pair off. Wasn't it the divorced or widowed men who always remarried right away, who had to be taken care of? Wasn't it the elderly women who reinvented their lives alone? Of all her friends whose marriages had split up, and by now there were quite a few, it was usually the woman who had the courage to step away from something broken. The men held on for dear life. "You'll be beating the divorced Brooklyn dads off with a stick," Pilar warned her. That was the last thing she needed, a guy with his own kids. She dated and dismissed a number of divorced men she suspected were mainly on the prowl to have someone around every other weekend to help with their kids. They didn't particularly charm her, the men she thought of collectively as the dads. She had to admit, though, that there was something captivating and even a little sexy about a man fumbling to pin back his daughter's curls with a barrette or braid a ponytail. As she turned onto her block, she could see Tommy O'Toole sitting out on their stoop. Oh, good. He'd insist on carrying her bags up the stairs and into the kitchen, and she'd be happy to let him. She waved. She wouldn't mind some help carrying the bags the rest of the way. But he wasn't facing her. He was looking at a couple walking from the other direction. The woman was on crutches, and, shit, it had to be Matilda. And the person walking next to her must be Vinny. They were early. Oh, well. She'd put them to work chopping vegetables. Maybe Vinny could carry some bags, too.
Chapter 41. Even though it was a little chilly to be outside, Tommy and Frank Sinatra were sitting on the stoop, which they both loved to do. Sinatra took up his usual position on the third step from the bottom, snout high, bulging eyes alert, tail happily thumping the cement riser behind him. Next to him, Tommy put his head in his hands and prayed. It had been a while since he prayed to God or anyone. When he was younger, he used to believe he could pray to his missing friends and relatives. He felt envious of his old self, the one who thought someone was listening. At first he'd stopped believing out of laziness, and then out of anger, and now it was more an apathetic meander. He wouldn't have called himself an atheist. Being an atheist required more belief than he had, a kind of determined certainty about mystery that he didn't think was feasible or possible, admirable or even desirable. Who could deny a guiding hand of some kind, a design to the world? Calling it science didn't explain it all to him either. He wasn't a believer, and he wasn't a non-believer. He wasn't something, and he wasn't nothing. He was a survivor. For a long time after Ronnie's death, he'd prayed to her. Not just those endless months on the pile when he was desperate and lost, but for years afterward. He was embarrassed to think about this, but he'd prayed to the statue, too. It had become a shrine in his house until one day he saw himself, caught his reflection in a window, sitting on a folding chair, talking to the statue, and he got scared that he was losing his mind. That's when he put the thing behind doors in a china cabinet. At first, he'd been terrified by Jack Plum's offer to sell the statue. But once he got used to the idea, Tommy was filled with relief. He'd had some sleepless nights imagining what would happen if he died suddenly, hit by a car, massive heart attack, and his daughters found the statue in the closet. Eventually, they would figure out what it was and what he'd done. Reshaping the story of their hero father would be bad enough, But if they knew he'd stolen from the pile and hidden the contraband, it would change their relationship to the story of their mother, too. He knew, God, how he knew, that if your memories of someone couldn't carry you from grief to recovery, the loss would be that much more incontrovertible. He'd seen firsthand how his children started writing the mythology of Ronnie mere hours after she was dead. If they knew about the statue, her death would become tainted by his actions, and he wouldn't put his kids through another loss surrounding their mother. He couldn't leave them with a stolen statue that would become the thing in the closet they had to hide. He'd dump it in the river first. He knew there would be complications to the sale, how to move it, where to put the money. But Jack Plum reassured him he would help with, as he put it, all the particulars. He was full service. But before they'd even gotten into the particulars,